For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Wonderful to be here again with all of you, particularly because this is a very, very special evening for our family. Tonight's lecture is dedicated also in memory of a wonderful young man, Moshe Aaron Gross, and it's a tribute to him, to both of these young men, that you all come together tonight. So tonight we're going to talk about the great controversy that has engaged the minds of the greatest minds of history. Normally it's the controversy called Jerusalem versus Athens, or Athens versus Jerusalem. Great writers, great classical writers, particularly Matthew Arnold, had and still have great essays and great thoughts and profound ideas about what lies between or underneath the controversy between the Greeks and the Jews, between the Hellenists and the Jews. So we'll talk about that in a little bit. But first I want to indicate that as part of that discussion, we're going to talk about Hanukkah, which is timely, current events. When we mention Hanukkah, because what comes into your mind as American Jews? Dreidel, right? Latkes, right? Sufganiyot, if you're an Israeli, you know, they use it in America too, Sufganiyot? What is Sufganiyot?
Jelly donuts.
Huh?
Jelly donuts.
Jelly donuts. A horror. Donuts filled with oil and then filled with jelly inside the oil. And it's all the rage in Israel. I mean, you can't move without Sufganiyot. You trip on them in the streets. And fun and games, and in some horrible abomination, an American abomination of Hanukkah. Hanukkah is known as the Jewish Christmas, and there are others who have Hanukkah bushes, and there's a Hanukkah man, and all kinds of things. So we know better. Al Hanisim is the prayer that we say during the 8 days of Hanukkah, and it's in the handouts that you have. And I'd like you to look at that prayer for a minute with me together. I got it. Yes, I'm back at page one, which is back two. So we say that in the Amidah, in the Shemona Esrei, during the entire week of Hanukkah. So the mirror, quickly, I'll read it through, but the key is the last couple of words. We thank God for all the mighty deeds and so forth and so on, and then there's a review of what Hanukkah is in the days of Matisyo and so forth. The wicked Greek kingdom rose up against your people to make them forget your Torah and to compel them to stray from the statutes of your will, and you stood up for them and so forth. You took up their grievance. You helped us, the few in the hands of the many, and so forth and so on. And thereafter, going towards the end of that, your children came to the Holy of Holies, the Beis HaMikdash, cleansed your temple, purified the site of your holiness, kindled lights, the menorah, in the courtyard of your sanctuary, and they established these 8 days of Hanukkah to express Hebrew, lehodos ulahalel, to express thanks and praise to your great name. And those are key words. We had them underscored. Thanks and praise. Lehodos ulahalel. Now, that expression, lehodot, from the word todah, which means thank you generally, but hodos means to acknowledge, to express thanks, to express gratitude. Lehodot. That word is central to Hanukkah. Hoda'ah is a noun. Central to Hanukkah is thanks and gratitude to God. That's the key. It's the key in that prayer, and it's the key to the mystery and the meaning of Hanukkah. Also, in the Gemara in Tractate Shabbos, which is on page 3 and 3a, if you're good enough to read it on page 3, it's fine. But if you're not, well, the translation is on 3a, taken from the Art Scroll Talmud, the back of 3. There, the Gemara reveals the origin of the holiday of Hanukkah. And then the Talmud talks about what the origin of Hanukkah is. I won't read the whole thing. But when the Syrian Greeks entered the sanctuary, they contaminated all the flasks of oil. Now, that's important. We're going to get to the oil later. I underscored it. They contaminated all the flasks of oil that were in the sanctuary. It doesn't really say that they destroyed and burned the Torah and this and that. They contaminated the oil. We'll get to that soon. And when the Hashmonean house gained the upper hand and vanquished them and so forth, keep going down to the second column, recognizing that the miracle had eternal applications and so forth and so on, they established and rendered, you with me? Rendered these 8 days permanent festival days. Again, that same word, Lahaba, Hallel uva Hoda'ah, with respect to the recital of Hallel and Hoda'ah. Again, that word, Hoda'ah. Thanksgiving. Okay. Those are the keys here. Hoda'ah. That word Hoda'ah is found throughout the Tanakh, throughout classical Judaism. The word Yehuda, Judah, Judea. We read it just last Shabbos in Shul. Leah, it's in the citations. Leah, the mother of 6 of the 12 tribes, names him Yehuda. Why? What word is in Yehuda? That same word, lehodot, to chant, to thank, to acknowledge, to have gratitude. She names him Yehuda because now I thank the Lord because I have all these many children. In the morning when you get up, you're taught as children, but you should still do it as an adult. What's the first thing you say when your eyes open? Mode ani lefonecha, I thank you, oh God. Well, same word, hoda'ah, mode, I acknowledge your presence, oh God. I slept, I was half in life and half not in life when you sleep, and I woke up, my eyes are open. Mode ani, I thank you, lefonecha, melech chai v'kayom, eternal king, shehechazarto binish mosi, that you returned my soul to me. But traditionally, the soul goes up for an accounting every night. Wow. And then it's given back to you. And you thank God for having given the soul back to you. Shehazad b'chemla, with mercy, rabba emunasecha, great is your faith. So there again, you have that same word, modeh, hoda'ah, thanks. Now, what has this got to do with the controversies in Jewish life? Has everything to do with it. The Talmud tells a fascinating story about Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great had conquered all the ancient world, Egypt, Syria, all of Asia Minor, wherever he went. He's a military genius, and he was a brilliant individual besides that. He conquered the entire ancient world. He was the king of the world, Alexander the Great. The Talmud says that this is in Gemara and Yoma, 32b. He came to a spot in Africa where he saw a stream of water that was like a magical stream of water. And he realized that this was not ordinary spring water. And he followed it, and there was an aperture there. And he realized it was the gates to the Gan Eden, to the Garden of Eden, where Adam and Eve cavorted. Alexander knocks at the gates and says, "Let me in. I am Alexander the Great." And they say, the gatekeeper says, "You cannot come in because," and the Talmud says, citing the verse in the Psalms, which is in your citations, it says in the Psalms, "Pishu Shari Tzedek, the gates of righteousness will be opened. Avovam, we will go into there. Odeh ka, we will acknowledge God." You don't acknowledge God. The gates to righteousness, the gates to the Garden of Eden, are only open to those who odeh, same word, who acknowledge the presence of God. And you're a great person, but you don't acknowledge the presence of God. But he's really one of the first Hellenist. The first Hellenist. He carried on the Greek. He began basically the Greek philosophy, which was that there's no one to thank. There's no one else in the world but me and you, human beings. There's no above. There's no supernatural. There's no transcendence. They don't believe that there was a creator of the world. The Greeks, the Hellenists, Alexander, and all the Greek Hellenist philosophy after him, holds in what's called in Hebrew philosophy, Kadmut Ha'olam, the eternity of the world. That is, the world always existed. I'm stuck here with the microphone, otherwise I come closer to you. But the world always existed. There was no creator of the world. There was always a world. Eternity of the world. So there's no one to thank. Whom do you thank when everything is your own power? You are all that there is in the world. There's no creation. The world always existed. And that's totally antithetical to Judaism, and therefore he was not given entry into the Garden of Eden. Now, let me ask you a question. What was the very first transcendental, supernatural occurrence in the history of the world? It's a trick question.
Light.
Hmm?
Light.
I can't hear you.
Light.
Light. Getting close. Getting close. Very. The first transcendental, supernatural miracle, all miracles are supernatural, occurring in the history of the world, the very first miracle is in the very first sentence of the Torah. Bereshis bara Elokim. In the beginning, God created. That's the very first transcendental miracle that took place in the history of the world. That is to say, creation itself is a miracle. That's what we believe. Creatio ex nihilo, as they say, the creation from nothing. In Hebrew, yesh me'ayin, that which came from nothing. That's what a major Jewish belief is. The world came from nothing, and God created something from nothing. That word, Bereshis, in the beginning, is antithetical to Greek philosophy. In Greek philosophy, there is no Bereshis. There's no in the beginning. There is no beginning, because it was always there. So Bereshis is antithetical, is opposed to Greeks completely. The Greeks believe that real absolute truth exists only in the mind, in the rational capacity and talents of a human being. What we can perceive. Anything transcendental beyond what you can see is lost to them. There's no reality beyond that which you experience with your bodies, with your eyes. If you can't see it, you can't experience it, they say it doesn't exist. As the Ramban Nachmanides says in his commentary in Vayikra and Leviticus, this is also in your citations, Nachmanides puts it clearly, this is talking about the 12th century. Anything not perceived or grasped by the mind, for the Greeks, simply does not exist. If you can't understand it, it doesn't exist. Therefore, the corollary of that is, miracles are impossible because you can't grasp it by the mind. It has nothing to do with the mind. All depends on logic. What you see is what you get. That's Greek philosophy. If you don't see it, it's not it. They couldn't live with the idea that there are things in this universe that we do not understand. Everything has to be subject to rational explanation. Thus, they don't acknowledge any outside power. That's why the classical Greek hero in Greek drama is a solitary, masculine hero. He's self-sufficient. He needs nothing but himself. He needs nothing beside him, not even a wife, not a woman. It's always a classic masculine hero, self-sufficient. Jewish heroes, interesting, you go through the books of Bereshit, which we're now doing now, now doing these weeks. Jewish heroes are never by themselves, they're never solitary. I mean, Abraham is great, right? But he has a sorrow. Yitzchak, great. Heavenly, angelic creature, but he has a Rivka. Yaakov, the third of the great patriarchs. Great patriarch. He has a Rachel and a Leah. These are the great heroes of our people. There's always couples together, not the solitary, lonely figure. We can talk about that at length, but I won't go into that now. We, Jews, Judaism, holds that we understand nothing. We really don't understand anything. Everything is a miracle. Everything is hidden. Everything is unrevealed. That we think we're knockers. We know everything. We have our iPhones, we have our this, we have our that. We have everything revealed. We have our Googles. It's all there. We know nothing, says Judaism. We don't understand childbirth, for example. We don't really understand the beauty of a sunrise or a sunset. We don't understand the color of trees in the fall. We don't really understand the cycle of the sun and the moon and the stars. We certainly don't understand the workings of the human mind. We don't understand thought processes. We don't understand the miracle of the human eye. I mention that because I just went through eye operations. I mentioned to my doctor that how is it possible, just looking at the eye and its complexities, for an eye doctor to be an atheist? He wasn't an atheist. I'm just saying, well, how could an eye doctor not believe that something made all this? Where does it all come from? We don't understand the body. Everything is God's, and therefore we give hoda'ah, we give thanks for all these miracles. And this was all, this philosophy of Judaism was a major threat to the Greeks. I have the word yavon up there. Yavon is the Hebrew word for Greek. Major threat to the Greeks. And therefore they have to uproot it. And this is the key to understanding Hanukkah. Everything about Yavon is opposed to Judaism. So they have to destroy the temple. It's not just because they don't like the Jews. They have to destroy the temple, the Beis HaMikdash. It's not just a destruction of a building. They want to destroy the presence of God in this world. And Hanukkah is centered on the cruise of oil, right? Here we come to the oil that we emphasized earlier in our readings. Let's take a fresh look at oil. Of course, you know the old joke, which I hesitate to repeat, but there's at least one person here who hasn't heard it. That is, if Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, when he came down the mountain, if he had turned right instead of turning left, we would have had the oil and they would have had the sand. Well, 2-3 people heard it. Okay. But let's talk about the cruise of oil. The cruise of oil. Let's fresh look at what that is. Look what oil is used for in Judaism. You use oil to anoint a king, Kohen Gadol also. Yaakov, in the reading of last Shabbos, he lies down on the stone and then he realizes the heavenly place. What does he do? It's kind of overlooked in the reading, but he pours oil over that rock because it's going to be an altar. Later on, in the 35th chapter, coming up in a week or two, again, God speaks to Yaakov, and there's a pillar of stone, and again, he pours oil over it, because again, it's a holy place. You know how many times the word shemen, which means oil, is mentioned in the Torah, in the Tanakh? Over 200 times. Oil is pervasive in Jewish history, in classical biblical Jewish history. 200 times, that word shemen. So the Greeks came and they defiled the oil. They didn't just defile the walls and defile all these beautiful things and other things, but they went after the oil because the Greeks are brilliant. They know what oil stands for and they're going to defile it so the Jews can't use it. Also, there's a deeper meaning of the menorah itself. Look how the menorah works. What's a classic menorah? We're not talking about the little electric bulbs and so forth. A classic menorah is you put oil into a receptacle, then you have a wick, you add a wick, and then you light the fire on the wick, and the wick draws up the oil from the receptacle. It constantly draws the oil as it burns, right? And it sustains itself, that fire, as long as the oil exists. There's no oil, the fire goes out. But the oil sustains the fire. Same thing with fire itself. Similarly with fire itself. Fire, when you look at it, when you look at the flames of the menorah, it looks like it's not moving. It looks like it's static. The fire is not static. What you see now in fire is not what you saw a moment ago. We're always seeing new fire every second. Each minisecond of fire is different from the previous minisecond of fire. In Judaism, the world is, and the universe is just like that flame. It's always moving. It's always dependent on the fuel. And what is the fuel of the world? God is the fuel of the world. He's the fuel behind the flame. Because God exists, we have life that comes from the fuel that is He. In other words, Judaism teaches us that nothing has independent existence. That's what reality is as far as Judaism is concerned. There's constant change in the universe, and there's renewal every second in the universe, and that's what we say every day in the davening, in the morning davening, weekday, Shabbos, Yom Tov, HaMechadesh, B'tuvo, B'chol Yom, Tomid, Ma'asev Reish, is in your citations. God renews in His goodness every day the act of creation. Every day there's a new act of creation. It's not eternity the way the... I don't mean eternity. It's not a world that wasn't created. It's something newly created every single day. Now, let's not denigrate the power of the Greeks, of Yavon, of the Hellenists. Look what the Greeks, what Hellenism has contributed to the Western world, especially. Drama, architecture, sculpture, art, all that the mind can master through the understanding of nature stems from the Greeks. Physical nature, physics, the intellectual and material universe all around us, our understanding of it and our conquest of it stems from the Greeks. The Greeks represent all the possible potential that a human being has for the use of his mind to understand and to conquer the physical world. All that the intellect can achieve. The Greeks represent that. And the Greeks, in addition, have this tremendous striving for beauty. Right? Beauty and harmony and order and balance and symmetry. It's all Greek. By the way, there's a Greek god in Greek mythology whose name was Harmonia. Harmony. This is, the Greeks worshipped harmony in terms of the physical world. Colors and shapes, the beautiful body, statuary, the columns, the Corinthian columns that still exist today. Extremely attractive culture, the Greek culture. No wonder that so many Jews in ancient Palestine were attracted to the Hellenists. The magnificent physical culture. The Greeks were obsessed by physical beauty and by aesthetics. And there's a famous poem cited in the citations. Some of you may recall it from your college days, high school days. Truth is beauty. Beauty is truth. And that is all you need to know on earth. Truth is beauty. Beauty is truth. That is all you know on earth and all you need to know. Who said that?
Keats.
Huh?
John?
Keats. Very good. I deliberately left it off the site. I left the title off. I mean, the author off the citations. So I wanted to see how many of you remembered your high school days. John Keats. Now, what's the name of that very beautiful poem? Ode on a... what urn? A Grecian urn. Right? It's an ode on a Grecian urn. He looked at this magnificent urn and he wrote some magnificent poetry that lasts all right until today. But it was a Grecian urn. Beauty is truth. Truth is beauty. Hetzach Mishtan. It doesn't begin for us. Not a Jewish concept. It's a Hellenistic concept. Beauty is not truth. Truth is not beauty. There's more to truth than simple physical beauty. By the way, the very name Yavon in Hebrew, here it is in Hebrew. This, I'm indebted to a young rabbi in the Kollel who mentioned this to me yesterday. The word Yavon in Hebrew is spelled Yud, which is just a dot, then a vav, which is a little bit longer, and then a nun, which is even longer, which is a perfectly symmetrical name. Just physically, the way you spell it in Hebrew is a little dot, a longer line, and a longer, longer line below the line. That's Yavon. Thank you, Rabbi Oretz, for that insight. Very, very nice. It's interesting. At any rate. Now, are Jews opposed to beauty? Not at all. Are we opposed to the Greek concept of beauty? Yes. Are we opposed to beauty, per se? No. The Beis Hamikdash, the ancient temple, was a magnificent, beautiful building. The Torah goes to great pains to tell us how beautiful the matriarchs were. They say that Sarah was the most beautiful woman who ever lived. The kings all wanted her, wherever she went. Beautiful. Abraham says to his wife, I see you're so beautiful, I'm afraid to take you down to Egypt. They'll take you. Joseph, about whom we'll read in a couple of weeks, Joseph is the only man in the five books who's called beautiful. There's another one later on, I think Avshalom, the son of David, is also called beautiful. There's only two men in the entire Bible that are called beautiful. Joseph is the only one in the Chumash that's called beautiful. What does it mean? What is Joseph? Beautiful? What does that mean for a man? We'll get to that in a minute. He's also Yosef HaTzadik, Yosef the righteous. So beauty. Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, is called Kelilat Yofi, the embodiment of beauty, the city of Jerusalem. You can even see the beauty today. If you look behind, you know, the gross exteriors that some of the builders have perpetrated upon us residents of Jerusalem. It's a beautiful city. It always was a beautiful city. Magnificent trees and rolling hills and atmospherics all around. Kelilat Yofi. The tradition calls it Kelilat Yofi. It's not a modern term. Yerushalayim, Kelilat Yofi. The essence of beauty. So we're not against beauty. We love beauty. We also love harmony. We also love grace. We also love flowing lines. We also love balance. We also love symmetry. So what does it mean then that, what did we fight Hellenism about? Obviously, there's more to beauty than meets the eye. There's more than this worldly thing is beauty. Sheker HaChein, the Hevel HaYofi, we say Friday night, the men sing in honor of their wives Friday night. Sheker HaChein, the charm is deceitful. The Hevel HaYofi and beauty is vain. What we mean is that just plain physical beauty is nothing. Isha Yiras Hashem Itesala, a woman who fears the Lord, he should be praised. But just physical beauty, it's fine to have a beautiful wife. Nothing wrong with it. I mean, I could tell you there's nothing wrong with it. but it's a physical beauty by itself is nothing. It fades, it evaporates. It's nothing. Sheker HaChein. So we have a different concept of beauty than the Greeks did. With them, beauty stopped with the body. With us, beauty has to be in harmony with the spirit. If there's no beauty harmonizing with the spirit, with spirituality, there is no beauty in the world. The key is not the beautiful body. The key is the beautiful neshama. Yosef HaTzadik, let's get back to him. He's the most beautiful man who ever lived. The Midrashim tell us that when Yosef had a procession through the streets of Egypt, all the women would climb the walls, get on the rooftops, just to get a look at him, at Yosef, at Tzadik. But Yosef is a Tzadik. So when the wife of Potiphar tries to seduce 17-year-old Yosef. He's a kid, 17 years old. She tries to seduce him because he is the most beautiful person she's ever seen. And he refuses. He refuses. In today's day and age, it's inconceivable, right? You don't say no to anything, you know, especially those things. But he refuses. So he has spiritual beauty. It's not just physical beauty. He refuses her advances and he maintains his spiritual harmony. But for the Greeks, there's no such thing. Beauty begins and ends with the body. And it's a very attractive concept, and it overpowered many, many Jews in ancient Palestine and today. You want to hear, I'm going to close soon, you want to hear a delicious irony? The miracle of the Hanukkah finding the oil and the miracle of its lasting 8 days. Why 8 days? 8 in Judaism is the number of transcendence. It's the number above nature. 7 days world was created. 8 represents beyond the physical world. The word shemen, oil, is similar to the word shmona. Same root, shin mem nun, which means 8. Shmona esrei, 8. Shmona and shemen, same word. 8. The high priest wore shmona begodim, 8 garments. 8, representing heavenly things. A bris milah takes place on what day? Very good. 8th day. Something beyond the physical. This is what I call delicious irony, because the great triumph over Hellenism, the ideology that did not believe in miracles, is completed through a miracle of 8. The ideology that would not move beyond physical nature is defeated by an oil that lasts 8 days that represents beyond the physical nature. Okay, to summarize, I hear a sigh of relief when the word summary is said. Okay. We're talking about the creature, which is Hellenism, versus the creator, which is Judaism. We're talking about the work of art, which is Hellenism, versus the artist, which is Judaism. We're talking about reason and the intellect and the mind versus revelation from a higher sphere. All this is in your handouts. We're talking about not a quest for physical harmony, but a quest for harmony with the spirit. Now, although we won the battle of light versus darkness, Hellenism is still very powerful among Jews in contemporary world. It still influences much of Jewry today. I mean, physicality is attractive. Intellectually attractive as well. People always still say to me, I won't believe X, Y, or Z until it's proven. Prove it to me. I don't believe it. People won't perform mitzvahs unless their intellects approve it, until their minds understand why they should. So the great controversy still rages between Hellenists, but Hellenist Jews versus non-Hellenist Jews. And classical Judaism wants us to serve God even when we don't understand certain things that He does. Even when we don't understand certain commandments that He gives us. Even when we don't understand that there's a world beyond us, beyond the physical, that transcends the physical world. So, as Hanukkah comes, please God, another week or two, as you gaze at the menorah, and it's good to gaze at the flame, You know, there's a Kabbalah. The Jewish mystics say that gazing at the Shabbos candles, looking at them, is good for the eyes. Interesting. I can see the whole shul is going to be gazing at the menorahs. I mentioned it to my eye doctor. He says, "No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't." I could go out of business if it's good for the eyes. But at any rate, it's supposed to be good for the eyes, says the Kabbalah. It's good for the eyes in a spiritual way. So as you gaze at the menorah flame, keep in mind to seek true beauty through harmony with the spiritual self. Keep in mind the message of the oil and the wick and the fuel that powers the fire. Keep in mind that it's incumbent upon us, lehodos lehallel, as we say in the Hanukkah prayer, to thank God, to acknowledge His presence. And if you keep that in mind, we're going to be greater than Alexander the Great. Because we know how lehodos, we know how to thank God, and we will be able to enter the Garden of Eden after 120 years, of course. But we'll be greater than Alexander the Great. Thank you very much for your patience.